Hello, everyone, and welcome back to episode 17 of the podcast and my interview with Tim Shoveller. Tim is the Managing Director of Network Rail's Northwest and Central Region, a role that he started in June 2019 after moving from Stagecoach, where he was the MD of the Rail Division. Previously, as Managing Director of Southwest Trains, Tim led the development of the alliance working with Network Rail. And earlier in his career, Tim was Managing Director East Midlands Trains from the start of the franchise in 2007. I am so pleased to be able to bring you this interview with Tim, as I've had the genuine pleasure of supporting him over the past year or so to build and develop his current executive team. And personally, I rate him very highly as a leader, and he's also a genuinely lovely bloke. In this episode, we explore his approach to winning the hearts and minds of everyone in the organisation, and also how to harness the knowledge, passion, and energy of everybody in the business, regardless of whether they are a junior train guard or a person in his executive team. We also touch on trust and leading remote, unsupervised workers, which has always been the norm for Network Rail, and much, much more. So, without any further delay, please enjoy my conversation with Tim Shoveller. Tim, welcome to the podcast. How are you doing today?
I'm doing really well today. Yeah, really well. Thank you.
Good. Tim, the very first question I always love to ask every guest that comes on the show to give listeners a bit of context is, can you tell us what your current role is and a little bit of the career journey or backstory, if you will, that's got you here?
Yeah, absolutely. So my current role, I am Regional Managing Director for Network Rail for the Northwest and Central Region of Network Rail, which is about 25% of the country's railway network. So it's a fairly big chunk, serving really important places from London to Manchester and Birmingham, Liverpool, all the way up towards Scotland at Gretna. And I'm responsible for the safety of all of the train movements for our staff, and for really delivering a really great service for our passengers. That's absolutely what I'm focused on doing. And I've been on the railway for 30 years. I joined as a train guard, actually, at Guildford. And I've done loads of jobs between then and now. In fact, someone called me a railway tart because I've moved around so much. But that was my own sort of management training scheme, if you like, to experience lots of different parts of the railway, which an industry I'm enormously passionate.
Wow, so that's quite some journey, Tim, if you'll excuse the pun. I'm sure that'll crop up a few times. But that's quite some career journey from starting out as a train guard to a regional MD now for Network Rail. Like, throughout that entire journey, how would you say that has really sort of shaped you as a leader? And what are some of the main leadership lessons you've learned along the way?
Yes, it absolutely has shaped my approach to leadership. And I count myself enormously lucky from having those experiences to the, sort of the front end of the railway and working with people who are still doing a similar job 40 years later, and, you know, with pride, passionate to do the same job for 40 years. There's a lot of that in the railway. So I think having that insight and an experience of working with some fantastic people, and frankly, some people that weren't fantastic, and seeing some of the dodges that went on and what have you, has been an enormous value to me. And I think the point that I learned quite quickly, actually, as a very young man, was that, of course, whilst the railway was organised along sort of military lines originally, the thing that was so important is the hearts and minds of the people that are actually running the railway on a day-to-day basis. And therefore, the leadership was so critical, as distinct from management, because whilst people will come to work if you pay them, well, they might, actually what you get out from them, the value that you get from the individual, is really dependent on their level of motivation. And in a railway setting where most of our people work on their own for most of the time, the point about discretionary effort, that effort that someone contributes because they want to, because they care, because they're passionate, as opposed to that they have to because they're being supervised or they have no choice, is so important because of the, as I say, the nature that most of our people are on their own.
Yeah, and Tim, actually, here's the first off-piste question, if you like, that I hadn't planned to ask, but they never inevitably always crop up. So obviously, we know each other, been working with each other for a while now. And what you just said reminded me of something I've heard you say quite a few times before, in that you're leading an organization of thousands and thousands of people who mostly work unsupervised. I just wonder, and your points there around winning the hearts and minds and motivation and discretionary effort, do you have any sort of tips, insights, thoughts on best ways to lead and motivate people when you're not physically with them all the time? Because for many leaders and other people listening to the show, actually the last 6 months with COVID has probably been a complete change, where we're suddenly trying to lead and motivate people who aren't physically present with us. Kind of, what are your thoughts on that, Tim?
Yeah, so it's an interesting parallel, isn't it? Yes, you know, people who would have used to have worked in an office where there's perhaps a degree of supervision, or in some respects a very high degree of supervision if you take a call center, and perhaps now working at home. I suppose the word that stands out there is trust, isn't it? Because it's about, I think, our ability to trust one another, so that even if I'm monitoring you on your output, that actually we've got a relationship and that we've got trust, so that you're going to keep delivering well and keep working appropriately, whether I know that immediately or not. And therefore, that's a very personal thing and is driven by relationship. And I think that so the relationship between an individual worker and their supervisor or their manager, I think, is absolutely fundamental. And yet I think that's one of the things that we perhaps don't talk enough about, the ability to have managers and supervisors in that front line who are supporting their teams and leading them through their own development, leading them through the tasks that they're doing. Able to have honest conversations with them when things are perhaps not where they should be. They're all really basic things, and yet actually I don't see us putting, as a country perhaps, when I reflect on, I wonder if we spend enough time focusing on that, because I think that's just an area of huge productivity and huge importance if we're going to get this right. There's no doubt that COVID has exacerbated that, and perhaps but are we better for it? Does that create a more trusting environment? Now, the challenge is, I've also got plenty of evidence over my career of when it's difficult to trust, and when people let you down, and when things don't work out as they should do, because, you know, I guess we're all humans, and if there's a shortcut available, people might want to take it. So I think it's that, you know, is it that motivation or that carrot in the incentive, but knowing at the same time that there are consequences if people don't deliver what they've promised. And I think in equal measure, and as long as both are present, then I think it can work. But I don't underestimate the complexity of it.
Yeah, there's two follow-up questions I want to ask Tim. The first one is going back to something you said a short while ago as well, about one of the things that you've learned along the way and has been really important. I mean, not just for you said, but in terms of the railway as an entity, sort of really winning the hearts and minds. Like, how have you gone about that over the years? What's been the strategies, tactics, some of the things that you've done? What does that look like on a day-to-day basis for somebody leading a group of people?
Yeah, I think there's some really important qualities that open and honest communication, I think, is absolutely key. Because I think you can motivate people even if the news is bad and times are difficult, as long as there is a very open communication style that hopes to engender trust, such that the employee is encouraged that actually the person they're having the conversation with, their manager, actually, you know, does understand. They're not insulated from the consequences. They're aware of the nuances of decision making. So that straight away, good times or bad, there's opportunity to build trust, and there's opportunity to build respect, mutual respect between people. And that actually then, of course, that allows conversations to take place where you can harness the energy and the ideas, because obviously often people on the front line have got a perspective. We don't actually have the whole answer, but they'll have a perspective which ideally then allows someone else to think, right, I didn't know that. But if I link that perspective together and that perspective together, we can do this over here. We can actually connect the power of different people's thoughts and understanding and find a different way of doing something, a more efficient way of doing a task, perhaps not needing to do the task at all. But again, I think you really get that sort of granularity and that power, if you like, when you've built trust. Now, of course, then the brilliant opportunity is to turn it around and say, great, so thanks for that idea. Let's do it. Yeah, let's do it. You've really contributed. What you said is it might not be the entire aspect of the entire plan in its own right, but actually, you know, you've mentioned this problem about, I don't know, let's take an example about the reliability of a particular component not being good enough. You've come up with a suggestion. Actually, I've talked to one or two others, or you've talked to one or two others, and we now know that the right thing to do is this. That here's the budget. Get on and do it. Here's the investment. We know that there's a business case here. So encouraging people to have a voice, to be heard, and then to enact, I think, sounds enormously simple when I'm saying it like I am now. But that to me has been, I think, a hugely important part to allow people to do their job. So many people are frustrated about the inability to do the job, things that get in the way, red tape or perception of. So actually, when you can give that impression that you're freeing things up and allowing people to have, offering people responsibility for their area, then I found all those are good ways of creating that discretionary effort that I talked about earlier.
Yeah, that last piece you mentioned there, Tim, is a theme that's come out of quite a few of these interviews with MDs and CEOs, in so much as a number of them have described how they see their job as really sort of clearing the way, clearing the road, getting rid of obstacles, whatever they might be, sort of bureaucracy, red tape, kind of budget restrictions or whatever, to enable people to get on and act with sort of freedom and without frustration.
That's a great summary. And of course, there is that thing about perspective, isn't it? You know, an employee working on the front line may not have an understanding of the whole system. They might not understand how the economics of the system work, for example. Then they might not. So I think that's where we can add value then, to make sure that you can bring together the right grouping so that you have got the system represented. You know, an old boss I used to work for used to talk about, if you understand how the money flows, then you're halfway to understanding how the business works. That really simple statement is actually a lot harder to do in practice very often.
Yeah, absolutely. And do you want to circle back to this topic of trust again for a few minutes, Tim? Again, you mentioned how you always tried to trust people, and from time to time, people will let you down. And that's something that in my work with people stepping into their first senior leadership position, they're often worried to sort of give people more choice and freedom about how they act, for fear of, well, what if they let me down? And sometimes that can even prevent people from trusting kind of those that they lead to get on. I just wondered, on a sort of slightly more granular level, how have you dealt with that personally in the past, when you've given somebody some trust to get on and do something, and it does feel as though you've let you down? Because the danger is, when that happens, is we sort of batten down the hatches and stop trusting people. So again, what's your experience and what's your advice to other leaders there?
Yeah, spot on. And it's painful as well, of course, isn't it? Because you've made that invested trust in someone, and then it's not worked out. There's often a pain associated. There's an emotion, perhaps there's a better way to describe it. There's an emotion associated with it as well.
Yeah, I guess because it feels like it's your personal reputation.
Absolutely. Your personal reputation. Yeah, but also, I trusted you and you've let me down. Well, actually, can I trust you again? You know, so how are we going to fix this? I think one of the most important aspects for this to me is to understand why. Was it because the individual was well-meaning, had good intent, perhaps overreached themselves, perhaps made a tough decision, because let's face it, we all do it, and it didn't work out? Or is it because there was another agenda, perhaps they generally weren't interested? So I think trying to understand the intent behind it is the key, because I think then that allows a decision in terms of, okay, well, what are we going to do? Because if it's the case that the former, where the intent was positive but it didn't work, then I think, you know, we can work with that. We can adjust and we can talk and make sure we don't, you know, try and avoid that situation again. If the suspicion is that actually there isn't acknowledgement, perhaps on the individual's behalf, that they've that they have failed or that they have let you down, that they've got something wrong, if it's defensive, if the behaviour is one of trying to blame others rather than acknowledge own improvement, it's very much harder to work with an individual like that again, because if they're struggling to acknowledge that they had some responsibility for the failure. So I think that would always drive my decision then in terms of what happens next. And I think whether I'm talking about, you know, in more junior roles, when I might have been talking about a train driver who'd had an incident, for example, and had perhaps had a safety incident, and as a result of that safety incident, you were having to make a decision about whether you could trust them to, after perhaps completing some retraining, to go back out and do the same task again, where the consequences could be really, really severe if you get it wrong, if you go through a red signal, for example. And whether you would trust that individual, whether you'd invest the time and effort and energy in them and with them to allow them to become a better train driver, or whether you would actually decide that actually you couldn't trust that individual, in which case it was, you know, there's a different discussion to have. And I very clearly remember an example where, I mean, this is going back a long time, but where a driver said to me, that has nothing to do with me, Gov. You know, it was everything other than that individual's fault. And he even recollected the train making a particular noise that it would do if the wheels were slipping. And I knew that train wasn't even fitted with that wheel slip system. So, of course, it just completely destroyed my trust. And I was just thinking, well, I can't justify putting you back out to do the same task again, because actually I've got no confidence that you've acknowledged your own role in it. So I think that would be my dividing point. And then, of course, whether it be a frontline member of an employee or a more senior manager, you know, if it's the former and we know we can do this again and we can learn from it, then we'll move on and we'll take collective responsibility. But if it's someone that's running away and won't take any responsibility, then of course, that's a different conversation.
That's great. And Tim, changing tack ever so slightly for a minute, if, thinking about your entire career journey from train guard to managing director, of all the transitions you've been through in that career journey, what would you say was the most challenging one, and what did you learn from it?
Yeah, I think it would have been the first time that I went from being a manager to a director, and I still remember that quite clearly. That it was quite a significant change in mindset. I felt from being in a responsible place with a big role, but then when I became the director of the company. And it was a legal entity. So you, all of a sudden, there's a whole raft of other aspects which you sort of open your eyes to. And I think I found that was probably the biggest, the hardest step to make. And it took me a good year or so. Well, you know, never stopped learning, but it took me a good year, I think, to start to get comfortable with it and to be able to. Still, I think, become comfortable with having those director responsibilities, but also still being able to sit in the mess room and talk to teams on the front line. And I think understanding what's expected of you. I think as soon as you get a big title, then of course, even if you try and come across in the same way you might to frontline teams, very often they will see you in a different way. So I think trying to be very aware of how people perceive you by the title that you carry and the office that you hold, that's something which I learned quite significantly at that stage. And there's no magic bullet to this. You just have to keep working at it. But that was quite a big step.
So with the benefit of hindsight, which is always a wonderful thing, right? Is there anything you now know that, looking back, actually, if I'd done that, I could have accelerated. I could have got to that point of comfort and really performing well in that director role a little bit quicker, or is it kind of just awareness and the passage of time are the things that are required?
Yeah, it's a great question. So one of the, because I was conscious of that for myself, when I have other, when I was appointing directors for the first time, I'd always try and relate this conversation in one way or another at an appropriate time. And the advice or the discussion that I often used to have was really sort of saying, look, you've been appointed a director because of the fact that you've got a whole load of skills and your personal attributes, technical knowledge, a whole load of things have got you to the point where you've now been appointed as a director. So just because you are now a director, don't change. Don't stop all those things that you used to do and those positive attributes that got you the job in the first place. Don't feel that just because of the fact that you've got your name at company's house and that you're running a big organization, don't feel that you now must go about doing things in a different way. Just carry on doing what you were doing. Do them better, do them more. But don't feel as though you've got to put on a false pretense. But be very aware that other people might perceive that you, you know, because there's this thought about titles and seniority, other people might perceive that of you, even if you don't. So actually, the more grounded you can be and the more honest and open that you can be in the way that you communicate, all of which I think brings you back to authenticity, which I think is a huge, important part of leadership, the better you'll be. I must have, I don't know if I've ever gone back and double checked and said, did that advice work for you? but that's certainly what I would say from with hindsight.
Great. And for you personally, Tim, are there any particular leadership tools, models, frameworks that have served you well throughout your career that sort of you find yourself relying on or going back to?
My experience, so much of my experience is learned. So I think the thing that I always keep coming back to is this thing about accountability and delegation. I very strongly believe that people and teams work better if there is very clear accountability and everyone, you know, we know where we stand, and that's supported and enforced, because that cuts both ways, doesn't it? There's a responsibility to manage, and as well as a responsibility to do the task. So I think in terms of creating teams that have clear line of sight to know what they're delivering, they know exactly what they're accountable for, they're empowered to get on with it, because clearly that's an essential part of that, and then they're supported. That's the way that I typically always organized my businesses, and where I found significant benefit from organizing businesses in that way. Small overhead, you know, as a center, but really investing in the people that are outside doing the task, making sure that they feel as though they are accountable and that they are being held responsible for the decisions that they're making, but also they've got that supportive environment that they're part of. That's a consistent way of organizing that I've used.
Great. And Tim, at the expense maybe of making you blush slightly with this next question. So as I mentioned earlier, so I've been supporting you and your team for the past year, and it became really clear to me very quickly that all those that you lead have a huge amount of respect for you and seem to really enjoy working for you. In fact, I heard many people say early on that it was kind of more working for you that drew them to working within your region rather than necessarily the region or the role itself. So like with that as the backdrop, and you probably talked to this a little bit already, but with that as the backdrop, how would you sort of describe, how do you see your job as a managing director, and how would you describe your leadership style? Because it's clearly working very, very well.
Thank you. That's a toughie, that one. I mean, I'm very intuitive. You know, I tend to sort of, I work quite a lot on feelings and emotion, and you know, I think my job is to support my team. My role is to, in terms of the exec that run Northwest and Central, the leadership team, in appointing them, in working with them, in helping them to be the very best that they can be, is fundamentally my job. And you know, encouraging them, that they then cascade that down through their organisations, and that we as a leadership team model that behaviour and live by it. You know, we can have some fun. This is you know, serious business, but at the same time, it's important that we've got good personal relationships and that to build that trust that I've talked about. I think it's so important. But I think that real, and then perhaps a real vision in terms of what are we trying to achieve. You know, I think the reason that I can be an authentic leader is because I am so passionate about what we're doing. We're moving millions of passengers every day, and 40% of the freight on the country's railway. So we have some really important jobs to do. We've got to do that while keeping people safe. And the railway is a very safe place if you use it properly, but it's not if you don't, whether you're working or a passenger. So you know, the consequences of getting it wrong are high, but tremendous rewards when we do it well. for the environment and for the people that use it. So I think there's a lot. I'm very lucky, you see, I think, in that respect, that actually the task that we have is one that really does make a difference to people's lives and to the country and in our economy. So very fortunate that actually, in terms of trying to motivate us to do that better and to keep searching for better ways to do it, it's something that I think people can really enjoy and have a real value in the work they're doing.
Yeah, good. And Tim, there's one final slightly longer question before we move on to a few quickfire ones to wrap up. So I'm aware that pretty much every quarter, I think, for the last year or so, you and your team have invested the time in taking normally sort of 2 days out from the busy day-to-day of running a railway to effectively have a leadership team offsite, be that physically or virtually over the last year.
Yeah.
And kind of, I don't know, my gut feel is that's probably 65% looking at and working on the team, 30-35% on the business. I'm really curious to understand, because I'm sure the listeners will as well, why do you put so much emphasis and priority on doing that on such a regular basis when, let's face it, kind of over the last 6 to 8 months with so much going on, so many demands on our time, that could have been one of the things that's very easy to chop or cancel. I'm just really fascinated to understand sort of the logic and mindset behind that and maybe some of the benefit that it's bringing. And just to be clear, I'm not talking about any benefit that I might have brought in supporting you. I just want to know, yeah, what sits behind your sort of steely determination to keep investing that time.
Yeah, I mean, it is a priority. It absolutely is a priority. And you know, they're in the diary for next year. They're the first thing that goes in. I think so much of it is because I talked about the team and the power of the team. As a collection of individuals, each of them is very talented. But of course, when they come together and work collectively as a team, irrespective of their discipline, then of course the power of that is enormous. And for people to be able to work together, I think they've got to trust and respect each other's position, understand that their tasks might be different, but actually none of us can do this on our own. It requires all of the disciplines to come together to work effectively. If we're going to be at our very best. So therefore, it's inconceivable to me, and when I've taken over businesses before where there's been directors around the table where there's been animosity and where there's been disagreement and where there's been, people that build empires, for example. Of course, what I saw was a whole lot of behaviour about sort of, you know, keeping tanks off other people's lawns, and where one director would fight another directorate because of the fact that actually everyone knows the HR director and the operations director don't get on. And then, of course, their staff then follow that behaviour. I've seen so much of the negative that actually it feels like a no-brainer to me to invest to make sure that we don't get to that position. And I think we don't get there by two ways. One is the investment to try and, as I said, make sure that people do feel as they are part of that executive team, and that we sing across the room together, and that actually, of course, we can all learn from one another and help each other to do our jobs, irrespective of where the overlaps might be. And of course, there always are. But actually, if we do that in a positive way, then we can generally help each other out. And if a colleague is struggling and there's a particular issue, actually other colleagues can help. Isn't that a much better place to be than the one where actually, you know, a colleague's struggling, others are laughing, thinking, wow, great, well, you know, you'll get the bullet soon and what have you. And I've seen all those behaviours. So I think the investment is a no-brainer. I think the power that, the message that sends to the organisation then, if they see the executive team as a team, where actually the behaviours are supportive and that we can work effectively across organisations and across directorates, means that irrespective of, you know, you could spend an awful lot of time redesigning your organisation, but actually, of course, what this gives you is the agility to get the, you know, the right answer to the question at the time, irrespective of who that person works for or where they are in the organisation, because if that's the priority, then that's what we'll do. So, and of course, it's good fun as well. It's great fun. I mean, at the end of the day, it means that, you know, there's a sense of trust. It was, you know, one of our team's birthday on Saturday, And, you know, of course, a card was written and flowers were sent. But wasn't it wonderful that everyone joined in on the sort of WhatsApp group? And, you know, probably before 9 o'clock in the morning, everyone has sent birthday greetings. And it was genuinely meant. I think that's a much better place to work than some of the others I've experienced.
Yeah, I love your point around really focusing on developing the leadership team and their agility rather than continually restructuring the organization. I think that's a trap that many organizations can fall into. Tim, a couple of quickfire questions to finish up. What are perhaps the one or two books that you've read that have really had a big impact upon you as a leader or otherwise?
Oh, that's a really good, you know, that's the one I should have thought about before I came on, wasn't it? I have read some really good books about collaboration, David Archer, I think, and because I think that brought to life very clear for me how more effective we can be if we do work in that style.
And is there anything that you are reading about, learning about, or curious about right now?
Well, I'm curious about loads of things, yeah. But primarily about how we encourage passengers back onto the railway, where of course the working trends, as you said earlier, people are working from home in a way that I think was unimaginable a year ago. That has a massive impact on us. So I guess I've been really interested in the psychology that sits behind when people meet and how they meet and what they're meeting for when they're at work, because I think that's going to be enormously important for us as leaders to understand that, both the expectations that our teams have, but also what are the limits and where is a physical presence and physically getting together, you know, where is that essential and how often is that essential? So I think there's a new, yeah, I think we're making it up as we go along at the moment, inevitably, because of the circumstances of COVID. How we professionalize that and optimize it, what good practice looks like, I think is something my mind is very, very open to at the moment. And I'm hoping that does obviously mean that we decide, yeah, actually working from home does have some advantages, but it also has disadvantages, and therefore there's a balance that humans coming together to experience the benefits of working together, building collaboration, building trust. I think it's quite difficult to build trust over Zoom or Teams, I suspect those are the areas. So that's a huge focus for me, because I think that's going to determine an awful lot of what happens in the next 10 years.
Yeah, got it. And final question, Tim, do you have any particular routines, ways of working that you've developed over the years that are particularly effective for you?
Do you know, I think the most important thing is to try and keep perspective. You know, I'm not the most structured of people. You know, there are people that are much more, and I see my colleagues, you know, who are much better planned, much better organized than I am. I am more of a creative person, so therefore I'm, you know, I could be more organized. So, but what does work for me is keeping a perspective and making sure that I enjoy what I do. You know, I'm really always motivated by that comment that if you do something, if you're lucky enough to do something that you enjoy, you're inevitably going to be better at it, which is just common sense, isn't it? So I work really hard to make sure I do jobs that I enjoy, because I think I would probably be pretty terrible if I was doing a job I didn't enjoy, and wouldn't be able to provide any, you know, the leadership and the support that I've been very lucky and able to do.
Tim, thank you so much for coming on the show. I always come away from our conversations feeling energized and sort of mentally stimulated. So thank you very much. I'm sure everybody who has been listening will also have taken great value from our conversation. So finally, once again, thank you for your time and coming on the show.
My pleasure. It's been great to reflect.
Thanks, Tim. There you have it, folks. My interview with Tim Shoveller, the Managing Director for Network Rail's Northwest and Central Region. A particular highlight from that episode for me was around Tim's thoughts and approach when someone hasn't quite lived up to the trust that we've placed within them, especially his point around really trying to, first of all, understand the intent that sits behind their actions and then use that as the basis for all future decision-making. As always, if you are enjoying the show and getting value from it, it would be incredibly helpful if you could head over to iTunes and subscribe to the show and share it widely amongst your network. Both of those two things allow us to grow the audience which in turn enables us to keep bringing you more and more interviews with great MDs, CEOs, and genuine subject matter experts to help you on your journey to becoming the best leader that you can possibly be. That's it for this episode, folks. Take care. I'll see you soon, and lead on.